Welcome to the Marvel Cinematic Rewind, the podcast that rewatches reviews and sometimes get a really cool guest for every movie, show, one-shot, and special presentation in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I'm Tony Camarena.
And I'm Al Rodriguez.
And you can follow us on Instagram at MCU_Rewind, also on X, aka Twitter. You can rate us on whatever podcast app you are currently listening to, which is really the best thing you can do for any show.
That's right. For this Skrull episode, we are extremely lucky to have Cheo Hodari-Coker come on the show. To those unfamiliar, Cheo Hodari-Coker is a writer, producer, and he was the creator and showrunner of Netflix's Marvel's Luke Cage. He also co-wrote Notorious, which was a biopic on the Notorious B.I.G., and he also wrote for Creed 2 and Almost Human. And just giving everyone a quick heads up, during this interview, there was a little bit of explicit language, so just letting you know now.
Hi, Cheo. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. I mean, you know, I'm honored to be here.
So to start off, you know, we're a nerd podcast, we're a comic podcast. What's your history with Luke Cage and Marvel Comics in general? Like growing up, did you read the comics or watch any of the shows, stuff like that?
I mean, one of the greatest days of my life was when I actually went to the comic book store in Willimantic, Connecticut, and bought the first issue of Secret Wars #1. And I was, not that Willimantic was particularly dangerous, but my only fear was that I wouldn't make it home alive to get home to actually read it. You know, I mean, because that's how much comics, you know, meant to me. Like, you know, for me, my first beginning with the Marvel Universe and my first entry point, honestly, was X-Men. I was a huge, I think the first issue I ever read might've been X-Men 173. In sixth grade, my friend Austin Orth, you know, was the person that introduced me to comics, and he started talking about, you know, Charles Xavier and Wolverine and all these characters I'd never heard about. Cause I mean, you know, it's crazy because nowadays kids grow up with movies. It's really easy to just go, even if you go to a comic book store, there, comic book store is easy to find. B, you know, they can buy book compilations, whatever they can't find. You can just go to Amazon or somewhere else and, on Comixology, and just download every single comic you've ever wanted to read. But I go back to bags and backs. I go back to, like, you know, looking, remembering one of my dreams. And it's at some point, it's funny, I'm growing. I could actually do it. It's actually go to Mile High Comics in Colorado.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they used to have all the comics listed. And you'd be like, oh, man, if I could ever have enough money to get Fantastic Four #1 or something else, you know.
Right.
So that's the thing was I what I've always loved about comics was just, even though people say, well, that's comic book writing or that's comic booky, I mean, we as fans know just how deep and how well thought out comic book writing used to be, particularly at a period of time. You know, this was before, you know, Alan Moore was taken seriously and these things were like, you know, like regarded as literature. But that was what I always loved about reading comics, was that you were kind of part of a secret society, you know, for me. And then also once I later on, as I became a screenwriter, like and a television writer, comics were always a huge influence. Like, you know, Chris Claremont's God Love Man Kills. You know, another one of my favorites, of course, is the Chris Claremont, Frank Miller, Wolverine, you know, 4-issue series, you know, which is funny. You know, I've seen them listed for like hundreds of dollars each, and I got mine in sixth grade,
you know,
because I traded. I had the first 4 or 5 issues of Grew the Wanderer, and Austin had the Wolverines, and he traded them to me, you know.
Oh, wow.
And so there's that. And then at the same time, you know, the first run of John Byrne's Alpha Flight is something else that is influential. You know, but I'll get into why later on as we talk about Cottonmouth. And then also something else for me that was, I just remembered the, you know, Kraven's Last Hunt as being one of my favorite stories of all time, because it was the first time since, because if you're an old head Star Wars fan, you remember what those years felt like between the end of Empire Strikes Back and when Return of the Jedi came out. I mean, it was probably only like 3 or 4 years, but it felt like forever. and you were just wondering because there was nowhere to read. There was no internet. There was no, like, is Vader really Luke's father? And, like, you just were just like, how, what the hell is going to happen? Is Han Solo ever going to get out of Chiron, you know, out of, you know, freeze and carbon freeze? I mean, it was all that kind of stuff. And you had to wait for years, you know, and with nothing in between to find out when these things were going to happen. And that's what it felt like for me reading Kraven's Last Hunt when he shot Spider-Man. And then the next issue comes out and there's no Spider-Man. You're like, what the fuck? Did they really kill him off? Yeah, I mean, you know, and so all these things kind of in a way informed what I think is such a great medium for comic book stories, which is, you know, back then the 12 or 13 episode arc of television, because really what you're doing in terms of television storytelling is every episode represents an issue. And so because of the fact that they used to have those year-long arcs, those 12 issue arcs, it really translates really well. You know, that was one of the things I remember when I first had one of my big meetings at Marvel Television, because Marvel Television and Marvel Studios were two separate entities.
Yeah.
And Marvel Television is of course where Luke Cage, Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Punisher, and Iron Fist for Netflix, you know, where those came from. And I remember the first meeting with Jeff Lowe, like, you know, Jeff was a superstar to me. He still is. I mean, he's less of a superstar because I know him and he's a friend, but like, I'm still kind of, if you're a geek, you're in awe because of his Batman arc. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't get any credit for those Batman storylines, which largely the movies are based on, you know? Yeah. At the same time also, you know, the stuff that he did with Tim Sale is just, it's canon. You can't get around it, you know, not to mention the fact that he was also a writer on both Heroes and Lost. And so I just remember like having the feeling of meeting with him for the first time. I'm like, man, this is somebody that is a geek's geek, knows his comic book history left and right, but also as a television writer has something to say, as they say, you know what I'm saying? And so that was the thing that to me was so fascinating, you know, getting to meet him, auditioning for him, and then working with him was the fact that he really understood both genres inside and out. And then also as a writer, you know, could also talk on that level, which is increasingly rare in film and television to deal with that, with executives that actually understand the writing process, you know? Yeah. But yeah, like, you know, this is the long answer to your very short question. I'm obsessed with comic books and Marvel. You know, it's different now. I'm 51 years old. I've got kids, you know, I'm trying to still make a living at writing, but in a different way now. But at the same time, it's like, you know, there's so many untold comic book stories that I would love just to be translated correctly. And to ever have the opportunity to even be a part of that conversation for me would be a thrill, you know?
Yeah. Well, talking about your deep love of comics and your history with comics and then working with Marvel, which was part of an interconnected universe, so you've got many different fires going. Were there any instances where you wanted to use a character or you wanted to use a storyline from Marvel that they had maybe saved for something else or ended up using later and they said, nope, have a different idea, use something else?
All right, so I'm going to be very careful about what I say.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to get sued. But then again, the people that would have sued me got fired by Marvel. So I'm in a pretty safe place. But at the same time, you know, I want to be very respectful of talking about some of these things. I think some of these things are technically declassified. So
yeah,
I'm saying anything that's not declassified, Marvel, please forgive me. I meant no harm in just being a fellow fan right now as I say some of these things. But the way it used to work was there was the quote unquote creative committee. And then that was, I think Jeff Loeb was a part of it. I think Joe Quesada was a part of it. You know, there are various powers that be in what I would call New York. New York was kind of the Washington, D.C. of Marvel, because Marvel Comics are based there, right? And then you had Marvel Studios, which is Kevin Feige in the films. It's funny, the first time I ever met Kevin Feige, he was actually Lauren Shuler Donner's assistant. And I was a journalist for Premiere Magazine writing about the first X-Men movie. I wrote the first two Premiere Magazine cover stories on X-Men and X-Men 2. So I got to go to both the X-Men set in Toronto and then the X-Men 2 set where was it? It wasn't Vancouver. It was in Calgary. Mm-hmm. Kananaskisk. Which was the coldest I've ever been. But when you see that scene with Stryker, and which of course is Brian Cox, everybody knows from Succession, and Hugh Jackman, Wolverine, and he's kind of tied up and he's outside, and this is in X2. I was actually on set, off camera, watching that scene get filmed. So that's kind of cool. The other thing that was interesting about that whole thing was, this isn't quite hyperbole, but when I did that first X-Men piece for Premiere Magazine, I believe I was the very first American journalist to talk to Hugh Jackman because he had just gotten cast as Wolverine, mm-hmm. and they were filming his first scenes. And so, you know, Doug Ray Scott, who was in Mission Impossible 2, was originally supposed to do that role, and then he got injured on set, and his whole life changed.
Yeah.
Because that's when they had to find somebody, because John Woo, when he was shooting Mission Impossible 2, something was happening with because of the injury or because of reshoots or whatever it was. Mm. But Doug Ray Scott couldn't get out of his contract in enough time to, do the first X-Men movie with Bryan Singer. And so they had to replace him. They had to recast. And that's when everyone was hearing about this soap opera actor and singer from Australia that no one had seen. And of course, you know, this is the days of Ain't It Cool News, and you're hearing opera, like soap opera and singer and what? Like, you know, everyone was up in arms. And then the other thing, of course, and Geekdom is still like this. I mean, he's 6 feet tall. He can't play Wolverine. Like all these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I get to set and I meet this guy and he's just so nice. And at the same time, you can kind of see with the hair and everything else that maybe this could work. But little did I know that the guy that I interviewed was going to now be so identified with Wolverine that all these kinds of questions that people have are just silly, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was the other thing was, you know, so to get back to what was going on was Feige used to be an assistant for Laura Schuladonna, who produced that movie, got into Marvel, became the film guy, did Iron Man, the rest is history. You know, arguably the most powerful executive in all of Hollywood. And Marvel Television was an offshoot. Marvel Television was Jeff Lowe, Kareem Zrake, and the committee. And basically, that's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Iron Fist, Luke Cage, Jessica Jones. And then, of course, I'm going in backwards order, Daredevil, and Punisher. I forgot to shout out to my man, Steve Lightfoot, who ran that show. So that was the thing was, the weird thing about it was because both were separate, they used to share information. And so it wasn't like anybody would ever say, you can't use this. There was always this, what Jeff Loeb used to always say, it was, look, come up with anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
Writing for Marvel Television is like it's like being on the freeway, but if you hit a guardrail, we'll let you know.
Yeah.
And so there were certain things that like you wanted to use, but you couldn't use because it might not get cleared by the committee. So adamantium is one of those things, which is, I don't think still has been introduced to, my way around it was, of course, in Luke Cage is like I said, okay, so like I can't say, you know, Stark Industries, but I can probably say Hammer Tech. I can probably, you know, use Justin Hammer in a way. And people, for whatever reason, love that I was able to kind of connect. The fans really, really liked it. I thought it was just kind of a tiny Easter egg, but it kind of became, once people saw Luke Cage, I think in geekdom, it kind of became, you know, a kind of a cool way. Or not being able to talk about the Avengers movies, but calling it the incident and then referring to it. You know, so there are all these little things. I mean, so it wasn't, we had to get permission from, and luckily, you know, shout out again to Ryan Coogler. The character that was the girlfriend of Killmonger was supposed to be Tilda Johnson, a.k.a. Nightshade. And we had to basically, at the last minute, we realized, oh, okay, since this character, you know, even though technically that's who she is, but y'all aren't doing anything with her, you know, can we have that name? You know, can we do that? And he was like, well, yeah, sure. So that was the kind of thing that he had cleared. And because in season three, we would have made a much bigger meal out of who she was and Tilda Johnson and all that stuff. And, you know, of course, the season two arc of Luke Cage, as she goes from not being Stokes and being Johnson, what that means. And, you know, that's what we were building towards, you know, without getting deeper into season three, which is a whole other debacle.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it wasn't as much you would get stopped as it was certain things you would have to ask about. And then what was really interesting was, and this is hopefully one of this might make news, but fuck it. We as Marvel creators on the at Marvel Television didn't find out about the snap until we were at the theater.
Oh, wow. You know?
So, like, that probably might have affected what certain storylines, mm-hmm. you know, would have been had we known about that, you know? And so it was stuff like that, because basically once Feige got the power to break off from Marvel mm-hmm. and basically was able to make the films his own thing and quote unquote have the MCU not be touched or affected by Marvel Television. I used to always joke that the real Civil War wasn't the Civil War in, you know, as the movie, it was actually between Marvel Television and Marvel Studios. You know, there was always tensions here and there, you know, before everything got united now on Disney Plus and everybody's friends and it's all good. Mm-hmm. Probably because Marvel Television is gone. But
yeah.
But for whatever reason, there was these little things. And so that's why it's really kind of gratifying to a certain extent that now all of the Netflix shows have now been included into, you know, the MCU canon. And so now it would be interesting if, as these things get rebooted and rewritten, to see how they'll integrate in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Talking about the Disney Plus and the Daredevil being pulled in, and I mean, rumors of the Punisher, I don't know if you can confirm anything, and I don't expect you to. Don't want you getting into trouble.
What's great is, like, I kind of feel like a CIA agent, you know, what was really cool about being in Marvel was that when you were there, you could only talk about Marvel stuff with people that were in the building, and you mm-hmm. just learned not to talk about anything once you left the building when it came to the shows or it came to anything that you knew, you know? And so I kind of like that, because at first you want the announcement that you're doing a show or something else, but then it's only fun for about 10 minutes, because then you get flooded with, yo, can I get a job on the show? And everyone mm-hmm. wants to know stuff you can't talk about. And then it's a stress. And then you realize, I really like working in the quiet anonymity of not anybody knowing what I'm working on or what's happening. It's kind of blissful in that way. And then what you get used to is we all pretty much had open door policies at Marvel's Television with each other. So we were just friends. We talked about storylines and everything else. You know, Dario is a friend of mine who's working on Punisher. I'm sorry. He was on Punisher season one. He's now the one who's running Daredevil, the current version mm-hmm. of Daredevil. You know, we just, because he also lives in Washington State, like we're friends. We talk every once in a while, but I know nothing about the show. And I'm happy for that. And I don't ask, he doesn't see, doesn't tell. It's mm-hmm. it's great. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, I'm just as much as anybody else, I'll just be watching anxiously as he puts everything back together. And I'm really heartened to see so many of the old cast from the original show coming back, because I think nothing but great things will come from that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the best things about Marvel in general, but especially your show, is the casting. You have an amazing cast. I was curious about, you said that the showrunners and the creatives would talk to each other across shows. Mike Coulter is amazing as Luke Cage, as you know, but he was cast originally on Jessica Jones. Did you have input in his casting, or did you just get really lucky? And I'm also wondering, like, Defenders, did you have input in that since they were using characters from your show as well?
All right. So when it came to Jessica Jones and Melissa Rosenberg, also, you know, shout out to Melissa. She cast Luke Cage. Basically, when I came in, what happened is I got two scripts. I got the pilot for Daredevil and I got the pilot for Jessica Jones. Mm-hmm. And the experience of reading both for me was so intimidating. It was like, holy shit. How the fuck am I going to match this? Because they're so well done. But once I got past that, like Daredevil was shooting at the time. Jessica Jones was about to start shooting. And so they were about to cast Luke Cage. And it wasn't as much input as I was just informed, like, hey, we have some guys that we have in mind. This is what we think. This is the direction we think we're going. And I'm like, yeah, he looks cool. You know, I wasn't as familiar with Mike. I mean, of course, I had seen, you know, Million Dollar Baby. And I'd seen some of the stuff he had done on The Good Wife. But he, you know, he seemed to be just on paper and just in photos and just the few performances I'd seen, you know, the Third Men in Black movie, he seemed to be right. I didn't know that he was perfect though. But, and so, you know, not only seeing Jessica Jones, but then having the opportunity to work with him. And then also, you know, we were neighbors. And so like we used to live within walking distance from each other in Studio City. So it was always like, it was cool. It was like, I didn't really have as much input in casting him, but thank God Melissa cast him because she could not have picked a better person to play Luke Cage. Mm-hmm. And then when it came to Defenders, I mean, you know, it was just like, I didn't really have as much input as we just were just friendly with each other. Like, you know, because all of our offices were like on the same floor. So, you know, we kind of would talk things. And so they would ask me certain things about Luke and, you know, it wasn't, you know, as much input like being able to work on the scripts. That's what I would have loved. I would have loved if basically all of us all as the showrunners were the ones that wrote that show. I thought that would be really cool. But, you know, they needed us working on our show. So that wasn't going to happen. But you know, I thought overall, I thought it was a good effort. I thought it was interesting. There's certain things I might have done differently. But then again, it's hard to balance that many different characters. I mean, it's no different than how the Russos, when they did Endgame and, you know, the...
Infinity War?
Basically how there were certain things that was... They used the Guardians of the Galaxy slightly differently. There were certain things in terms of how T'Challa, you know, wasn't necessarily... you know, integrated in, you know, the same way that he might have been had, you know, Ryan had, you know, full input. Like that's what it is, but it's not like the characters are misused or misrepresented. It's just certain little things you might have done differently. But at the overall, I thought it was fun to watch, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of wonder if that's like, you know, you're talking about like, hey, you would have loved to write, for something for, you know, the Defenders. Kind of wonder if that's like, hey, you know, you're too important. I know you want to do this thing over here. That would be a lot of fun, but like, nah, I'm sorry. You're important. You're stuck with the good thing. I'm not saying boring, right. But like not the, it's the meal, but you know, you want this snack over here to write up. Right.
Well, I mean, you know, the only creator at Marvel that, I wouldn't say, because it wasn't like, because he's a nice guy, but like the only one that we didn't really hang with was Scott Buck. And that was the thing about Iron Fist, because, you know, because Finn got a lot of shit for Iron Fist.
Yep. Yeah.
But then people, fans, as much as they might have had issues with Iron Fist as a show, they loved our crossover in season two of Luke Cage. And honestly, the character was not that he was broken, but he was really easy to fix. And the thing it comes down to is that if you understand that the fist is summoned by summoning and focusing one's chi, you can't focus your chi if you're not balanced. And that was kind of the problem with season one of Iron Fist, is that he was imbalanced. So how is he going to light up his fist if he doesn't have a certain semblance of peace and centeredness? And so that was what we did for Luke Cage when we had him appear. It's like, why don't we have Luke at a point of emotional distrust and you know, all over the place, and then have reintroduce him as being this voice of reason and calm. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in a Kayla script and just how it just worked, it was beautiful. Just how you kind of, because people to this day are now saying, oh, there's got to be Power Man and Iron Fist. And that was, you know, because of how well it worked. And but that was kind of the thing was like, you know, I just kind of wish that we'd been able to do more stuff like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it, I mean, but the economics and the schedules make it hard. But I think now with a united, quote unquote, Marvel, and the kinds of budgets that Marvel Studios has been able to put into the television shows, I think a lot more stuff like that will, you know, will be possible. All I can say is, without now, this what much I cannot get into is our actual budget for Luke Cage.
Okay.
The only thing I can say without getting you numbers is essentially the catering budget on Game of Thrones is probably, you know, might have covered what we got per episode on Luke Cage. I mean, in today's modern environment,
mm-hmm. like,
it was a not bad amount of money, but it wasn't kind of the outrageous sums that are being spent on television shows today. I don't know what we could have done with that kind of money with our shows. But, you know, at the same time, I'm very proud of us being able to do what we did with what we have. What I always said is that culture is the cheapest special effect. So mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons I leaned into music. That's one of the reasons why I leaned into Harlem, is that I wanted the show to be interesting. That was the challenge. Could the show be interesting without Luke ever using his powers? And, you know, that was, and because we had such incredible actors, because we had Mike, because we had Simone Missick, because we had Theo Rossi, because we had Alfre Woodard, because we had Mahershala Ali, you know, and Reggie Caffey, rest in peace, and so many others, we really could always just have them act
mm-hmm.
and write for that, as opposed to special effects or fight sequences, you know. And so sometimes it's interesting reading comments on the show, because people will be like, well, the show was so slow. But I'm like, man, if you actually like drama, holy shit, this is, this acting is like, what the fuck? Like, like, wow, you know? And that's kind of where it's always been interesting, because I find that Luke Cage fans, although it's changing now, basically, if you were 25 and under, Black Lightning was your show.
Mm-hmm.
You would find Luke Cage slow. The music was off, according to them. But if you're like kind of 30 and up, then those were the fans that we got, because they were coming musically from the generation of music that, you know, that kind of was my Gen X hip hop mm-hmm. generation. And then at the same time, the sensibilities, like, I find that people like older, you know, that say that they don't like comic book shows or comic book movies, like, they watch Luke Cage and they're like, wow, like, I actually like this show. Like, that was it. Because we wait for so long in the first episode to finally get to his powers. Mm-hmm. And then when we do, they're like, oh, I'm more interested and more emotionally invested in this show than I thought I would be. So, you know, that's the one thing that we always really prided ourselves on. But then again, all of the Marvel Netflix shows tend to kind of live at that same benchmark, because
mm-hmm.
Punisher, Jessica Jones, Daredevil all worked on that level. You know?
Yeah. Are you concerned, like, with them bringing, like, Daredevil back for Disney Plus, or potentially if they bring Luke Cage, which we're all rooting for, are you worried about them, like, watering down the culture, or, like, you brought up a lot of Black issues in the show? Are you worried about them watering that down for the bigger Disney Plus audience that they're shooting for?
I remember, because, you know, Walter Mosley is a friend, and I remember the first time we had worked on Easy Rollins. Because mm-hmm. we actually sold an Easy Rollins TV show to NBC that ultimately we got very close to being greenlit. But I know this sounds crazy at the time. At the time, there were no Black leads in television, and they ultimately decided to go with the show Revolution rather than ours at NBC. And then the next year, Scandal blew up. And then all of a sudden, they were like, wait a minute, like, you know, you can't have a Black lead on television. Like, had maybe 1 year passed, we might have gotten the green light that we didn't get. for that. But I remember one of the lessons that Walter taught me when we were working on that version of E.Z. Rollins. He said, look, my novels are on the shelf. You know, he wasn't as worried about the things that we had to change, because his original unadulterated version of what he wanted to do was on the shelf, so to speak. And it really made me a lot more open-minded about what one can and can't do with an adaptation or a show. And so my answer to what you're saying is that I would hope that the things that I thought were important would continue to be important to whoever has the reins. And I'm not saying anything because, you know, like I if they came back and I was able to work on the show and schedule and everything aligned, I would love to, because I love our cast and I love the show and I love the character. But if someone else does it, you know, like I would hope that some of the same things would be as important to them as they were to me. And I think the fans also would be calling for that kind of thing too. You know, because it's hard when you kind of establish a certain flavor with a character.
Yeah.
To bring somebody else who doesn't necessarily have those same sensibilities, which is why, of course, you know, you saw this in terms of the you know, the Bourne universe, like the non-Paul Greengrass movies. You know, it was jarring. Like, wait a minute. No, we need to go back to Green. Like, you know, so who knows if we would be regarded with the same level of reverence or respect. But, you know, what I always say is, you know, regardless of whether or not Mike or myself or anybody gets, you know, comes back to a rebooted Luke Cage, mm-hmm. you know, I got to work with the Sean Connery Luke Cage. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, there's going to be a lot of iterations, you know, age and everything else are going to recast. But I got, you know, my Bond movies were with Sean Connery and Lois Maxwell, you know. And so I can say that about my cast when in that same context with Luke Cage. I got to work with Mike Coulter and Simone Missick and Mahershala Ali and Theo Rossi and Alfre Woodard and everybody that made that show, you know, what it is.
Yeah. So, talking about the cast and your decisions, with Cottonmouth's death in season one, that took everyone, that shocked everybody. Obviously, yeah. You know this. It's been years of talking about this.
Yeah, if you follow me on Twitter, like I get shit about every week.
Yeah,
but I always give it back because it's fun.
Yeah, no, and it allowed for especially Mariah's character development, how she became the kind of big bad in season two. How mapped out was this? Did you have the plan of the arcs? Or
very mapped out. I mean, extremely mapped out. Because, you know, people want to get on Twitter or X, whatever the fuck you want to call it. Be like, yeah. I bet you wish you had killed Mahershala Ali. You know, that was dumb. You know, I'm like,
yeah, right.
I'm like, dude, that was not what it was at all. Because Mahershala, and this is, and let's go all the way back. I'll take you all the way back to what I was thinking. I go back to my moment when I read, you know, Melissa's episode one of Jessica Jones and Drew Goddard's pilot for Daredevil. And I remember reading both and being like, holy shit, what am I going to do? You know, because you have with those characters, I mean, you know, Jessica Jones has Kilgrave, and you have the Alias comic book that Brian Michael Bendis did, and which gave us such great arc, Purple Man and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Daredevil has Kingpin that he can go against. And if they decide to do Kingpin, you got Bullseye. There are any number of canon characters that Daredevil has to go against. You know, Luke Cage, it was, as a comic, every other issue, he was going up against somebody different. There was no one iconic, like, big bad for Luke Cage. I mean, you could say to a certain extent, Stryker, or, you know, not Stryker, I mean, Diamondback, you know, like was that big bad, but it was different because when Melissa killed Reva in her first episode, which is Luke's wife, it kind of fucked up my canon. Like, I couldn't do the same thing where you had the best friends fall in love with the same woman and all that stuff in comics. I'd come with something really different. So that was a certain thing, you know, and there were just certain things I was just trying to figure out. So I said, okay, like, I think, you know, this whole thing with Cottonmouth seems to be interesting. You know, I like having Cottonmouth. I would love to create a nightclub, because basically Luke Cage is a Western. you know, Harlem's Paradise is the saloon. Luke Cage is the man with no name, you know, and every saloon has somebody that controls the action of the town, you know, which is our Gene Hackman character. In this case, that's what I'm going to use Cottonmouth as, right? If Unforgiven is the analogy that we're using. And so I said, okay, Cottonmouth is interesting for that. I loved Black Mariah, but because, I mean, Black Mariah in the comics was essentially Aunt Jemima with a knife. I said, wait a minute. If we're in the spirit of the comics, but not following the comics note for note, fans will accept it because, you know, it feels right. The same way, like when back in the day when Peter Jackson did Lord of the Rings, because he got the Shire right, because the Hobbits look right, you forgave him for not including Tom Bombadil.
Yeah.
You know, you forgave him for using storylines from the Silmarillion, you know, in Lord of the Rings, because the world felt right. And then you just kind of accepted it to the point now where, you know, you'll find huge Tolkien fans who have never read the actual books, you know, and seen or pointed out these differences. I mean, yeah, there are those who have, but, you know, but for the most of your casual fans, their entry point into Tolkien is now those movies as opposed to vice versa, you know? And so I said, okay, there are some changes and some certain things we can do. And so when it came down to killing Cottonmouth, for me, I wanted the audience to feel the same way that I felt at the end of issue number 12 of Alpha Flight when James McDonald Hudson adjusts his suit, Heather walks in, he blows up.
Yeah.
That's what I was going for. I was like, okay, what kind of rope pull could I pull that could just have everybody like, holy shit. And that also would allow us to introduce in this new way two different villains. So I said, okay, we'll build up Cottonmouth. We'll kill him in episode 6 or 7. And then we're going to bring in, you know, Diamondback. And so that gives us two villains for this season. And that's what I pitched when I initially pitched the character. And Jeff was like, whoa, we haven't done that. That's cool. Like, why don't we do it? So we stuck to it. And then ultimately what happened is that when we did Matthew Lopes, who started off as our script coordinator before becoming a writer in season 2, he wrote the audition scene that we auditioned all these different actors. So we finally got Eric Louie Harvey, who ultimately is who played Diamondback and really played him incredibly well. But when we were doing that audition piece, it was for Cottonmouth. And so Eric Louie Harvey had a great audition. And strangely enough, Ron Cephas Jones also had a really strong Cottonmouth audition. And that was the thing, was it was like, okay, these actors are so strong. But then at the same time, you know, what do we want to do with the age difference and everything with, with Mariah Dillard, if we're going to do this. Yeah. And because of the fact that we had Alfre Woodard and we cast Alfre, you know, how do we explain the age difference if they're brother and sister? Because, you know, the mold for Cottonmouth was going to be, if we couldn't get Ving Rhames, we were thinking, you know, when we opened up the audition, and that's when we got to, you know, Eric Louie Harvey and Ron Cephas Jones. We said, okay, well, Ron doesn't, like, in terms of a brawny character, because he's, you know, Ron was not a brawny guy, but if he wanted to be gangster, he could, because he had great gravitas when he wanted it. But I said, nah, I know I want him in the cast because he's such a good actor. Let me invent somebody. So I said, yeah, the old brother in the barbershop that never gets a haircut, that'll be him. Yeah. And okay, he plays chess. Okay, then yeah, everyone calls him Bobby Fish. Bobby Fish, boom. That was literally the level of character development for Bobby Fish. But we knew we wanted the actor, so we created Bobby Fish for Ron Cephas Jones. And then because Eric Louie Harvey, you know, from Boardwalk Empire, just had this brawn to him, we said, okay, you know, he could be interesting to have as Cottonmouth, but because we're going to kill Cottonmouth, you want whoever's going to be Stryker to have similar, you know, energy in a different way. So we said, okay, why don't we move, because he's such a strong actor, why don't we move him to being Diamondback? And then let's see who's out there that we can get to be Cottonmouth. Knowing always that, okay, the character's going to die in episode 6 or 7. And so that was when Mayfield, who was the casting director for all the Marvel shows and also was known from Netflix for casting House of Cards. I mean, she's one of the greats.
Yeah.
And she was like, have you thought about Mahershala Ali? And I was like, well, you mean the dude from 4400?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, House that's of Cards.
And she's like, well, yeah. And I said, well, yeah, I think I like him as an actor. I love him on House of Cards. You know, people are saying, oh, yeah, you know, like mm-hmm. they always act as if we were killing Oscar-winning Mahershala Ali, as
yeah.
opposed to a working actor who, you know, was basically one step away from having that big break. And so the thing was, he was the last person cast. Now, just in terms of we had cast all the other parts, and mm-hmm. We didn't audition. We just said we need an actor who we know, who we believe in, to just take this important part. And Mahershala was like, we were like, yo, that's great. And then I met with Mahershala, and Mahershala was like, you know, I'm doing this, and then at the same time, I also have two movies I'm a part of. And I was like, hey, as long as we can have you for our days, I got no problem with you doing these other movies on these off days, which is why he has the same haircut in Luke Cage, Moonlight, and Hidden Figure, because he was shooting all three at the same time. And so that was the thing was, you know, the second he stepped into that character, oh my God, you just knew what you were watching. It was like watching Pacino. It was like watching De Niro, like, you know, like the same way that Pacino was relatively unknown, but then the second he became Michael Corleone, you were like, mm-hmm. holy shit. That's yeah. what it was like writing for Mahershala as he was playing Cottonmouth. I remember being on set. It was his first day of work was because the way that Paul McGagan shot episodes 1 and 2, we cross-blocked it. So we were shooting scenes for episode 2 while we were shooting episode 1. We shot both simultaneously. And so we mm-hmm. shot all the barbershop scenes. Like over a couple of days. And that moment that you see in episode 102 or you know, the second episode of season 1,
yeah.
when Mahershala and Theo Rossi and the actor that plays Tone, when they all walked in, and you know how they all walk in and the music goes a certain way and you're like, holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling on the set was like, what the? We were like, yo. And then watching Mahershala do that scene, like it was when you have those kinds of actors, it was wild because watching those guys run through the barbershop scenes in episode 2, and then watching Mahershala and Theo and them on the roof in episode two, I forgot I wrote the scenes. I was just watching them, like I was watching as a spectator. Like those are the scenes I go back to when I'm like, oh, can I write? And I'm like, yeah, I can. You know, it's because when you watch them take them to these new heights, you're like, holy shit. And then all the things that Mike is doing in that scene without dialogue and just mm-hmm. Everybody's on their A game in both those things. I remember because I was on set for the first two episodes and Matt Owens was covering episode 3, which we're also shooting at the same time. Matt Owens, who now runs One Piece, is his show. So we were working on those three in New York while the rest of the writing staff, our writer producers, were in LA. And I remember calling, you know, Charles Murray and Akela and Aida and Jason Horwitz and everybody. And I was just like, yo, like, we got to rethink everything we're doing with Mahershala because, man, this cat, like, we can't do any of this mustache twirly kind of shit that we thought we were going to do with mm-hmm. Cottonmouth. We have to really ground it in something. And so that was the thing was, you know, we have this great arc. And then at the same time, you know, Mike is kicking so much ass as Luke Cage. And we're expanding his character in ways that we had that wasn't possible in Jessica Jones because it wasn't his show. And everyone is just doing their thing. And we get up to episode 7. And then, man, I remember like Al Free and everybody was like, oh, don't do it. Don't kill him. You know, like, you can't do it. You have to change your mind. And even Jeff Lowe was like, you know what? Are you sure you want to kill him off? And I said, look, man, I promised Mahershala that I was not going to hold him to the show. You know, because yeah. he knew after House of Cards that he really wanted to plant both feet firmly in features. And he did not want to be tied contractually to a television show that would that could cost him the opportunity to do other things. And so I said, we got, you know, no, I'm going to let him go because, I mean, you know, I made him a promise.
Yeah.
And so we get to episode 7. You know, he, of course, we know famously he dies.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was interesting. It was in the middle of episode 7 realizing, like, you know, the tweaks that we made to Alfre's character in terms of what happened with Uncle Pete. That was unplanned. Killing Cottonmouth was planned. The whole Uncle Pete thing in that context, when we originally had plotted it, it was more of a power-hungry thing. It wasn't emotional. And then one of the things that I realized, it was actually something similar to what happened to her character, happened to, I don't want to go deep in reveal because it's a person that I know really well, but that happened to her. And so we basically extrapolated that kind of vulnerability and those kind of moments into the reason being why Mariah was so angry at what Cottonmouth, you know, had said to her about Uncle Pete. And then we also, when we, you know, were plotting like the flashbacks building up to that moment. And it's one of those happy accidents, because when you go back to episode 1 of Luke Cage, when someone says Uncle Pete was good people, and that look on Alfre's face, it was just like she was just looking at something in the background. But when you actually see it, it looks like she's having a bad memory. And so being able to build that into our story, it made it into, you know, this other thing that really kind of fueled her character, particularly once we got it into season 2 and we were really able to fully mine that moment. But that was the thing was, you know, I still think it was the right decision, but it was crazy because it kind of upset the apple cart in terms of the show from the standpoint that people, for whatever reason, when they found out Cottonmouth's backstory in episode 7 before we killed him, he felt sympathetic to them. And we were in our own way trying to mirror, you know, the work that Stephen DeKnight did in season 1 of Daredevil when you got into Fisk's backstory. Mm-hmm. I think in a similar episode or similar time frame in that show. And we were basically, what's our version of humanizing Fisk? And that's what we did. And I don't think we expected it to be to the point where fans were just like outraged and so angry about it. I mean, so in a way we did our job because we made somebody who, you know, who did some despicable shit throughout the first 6 episodes. When he finally meets his comeuppance, people really cared about him. Mahershala, of course. I mean, he just took that character, and him and Alfre just did things to the next level. But I don't think we thought that the fans would be so angry about it. To the point where almost a decade later, I'm still talking about it. and then at the same time also, you know, and I feel bad because people like to, because they were so angry about what happened with Mahershala and Cottonmouth, they like to ridicule the character in terms of Diamondback. And really, I think that undercuts all the incredible work that Eric Lorraine Harvey did. Eric Lorraine Harvey did a great, incredible job as Diamondback. It took us a couple of episodes to fine tune who that character really was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because the contrast and, you know, there's certain things that we did in episodes 8 and 9 that probably, you know, in retrospect, we would have tuned a little differently. Cause then by episode 10 and 11 and 12, we really knew who the character was. I heard him a certain way, and we're in terms of how we were able to filter in who he was through the rest of those episodes, he balances out. But it's such a sharp contrast in what he was doing compared to what Mahershala was doing in terms of what the characters, what we were asking the characters to do, that I think that people kind of like, you know, didn't like him as the follow-up villain as much. And, you know, but it wasn't anything that he did, because I thought that Eric Lorraine Harvey did an incredible job. Yeah. He's also another actor I would love to work with again because he was so good, you know?
Yeah. All right. We're running short on time, but I know our fans and your fans would be remiss if we didn't talk about a potential season three. I know you can't say much, if anything at all, but I know you had it planned out. We saw that you recently tweeted a couple weeks ago about the Public Enemy songs that would be the season titles, the episode titles.
Yeah. Yeah.
What can you tell us, like, what comic arcs or movies would have inspired season three, if you can't get into details about a season three?
If I revealed the arc, it would also reveal the story.
Okay.
And then that I can't do, but what I will say is that episode 301, that first episode, was one of my favorite episodes of that I've written. Like, I think it holds up to anything I've written for the show, but like, that one was a great episode. And I think fans would have loved it. And mm-hmm. at the same time, playing Luke as the gangster and then seeing, it's really less Luke being a gangster than it is the politics of what, yeah. of what's happening in Harlem. Because if you go back into the history of Harlem, if you go back into, you know, the era of, like, you know, Bumpy Johnson, and at the same time, the, you know, Fat Tony Salerno and the Genovese crime family, who were also based in East Harlem. And then, mm-hmm. and then all the tensions between East and West. I mean, that was one of the things we were doing, was we were doing our Marvel Universe version of the real tensions that were happening, that, you know, Godfather of Harlem, of course, is, you know, is doing with that show. We were mm-hmm. doing our own version of that with Luke Cage. And some of those politics would have been great to play, you know, like, there's so much at some point, either I'll get permission, or at some point, like, I'll be able to really talk about those, because we had six episodes written. We had eight planned, fully planned out, and mm-hmm. We knew what the whole arc was going to be.
Yeah.
And there are clues as to the evolution of Luke as you go from Public Enemy number one all the way to the final Rebel Without a Pause, mm-hmm. in terms of, you can kind of extrapolate, because that's how I do certain things. You can extrapolate from the titles what some of the potential arcs would have been. But it was not, as people saying, oh, Luke's a gangster, he's not a hero anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about what comes with the mantle of responsibility that you didn't want. And how does one balance that out in the midst of chaos? And because certain things were going to happen that I think would have been really interesting. And it was that was writing the finale of Luke Cage. You know, the season finale of season two, which became a series finale.
Yeah.
You know, that was always one of my favorite pieces of writing for myself, that I loved writing. But that moment with Mariah, as she, when she says, no, give him the club, because, like, mm-hmm. I want to see how it corrupts him. It was interesting because when we filmed the finale, that scene with Rakim in the nightclub, the way it was written was that Luke Cage was supposed to have this reluctant look on his face when, as he's standing in his suit in on the perch, you know, where we've seen over the seasons, Mariah and Cottonmouth stand, whoever's in charge of the club stands in that one place on the balcony, mm-hmm. right? And as I wrote it, he was supposed to be reluctant. You're supposed to see that reluctance. Mike didn't play it like that. Mike played it like, I'm the shit. And yeah. Mike made the right decision. Mm-hmm. Because he could see something that I couldn't see, which is that, like, even though Netflix kind of noted us to death on this, that is what Mariah was talking about. You think you can change things, but then at the same time, when you get a taste of what that is, it changes you in different ways that you didn't anticipate. So when you got Rakim on stage and he's saying, shout out to Luke Cage, he does a little salute and everything, the way Mike played it, it was like, oh man, did he really cross over? And then, of course, there's that shot that was deliberate on my part that we stole from The Godfather, where the door closes on Misty as Sugar whispers in his ear. Sugar is, was one of my favorite characters to write. Because, you know, when you have small characters that end up being mm-hmm. so great and on the show, whether it was, Ron Stevens Jones as Bobby Fish, whether it was, D.W. or D-Dub, You know, yeah. Whether it was, you know, Rob Morgan, who, even though Turk, of course, was a staple of the Daredevil universe, he was a whole character for us. Every time we got a chance to work with Rob Morgan, we always did really fun, interesting things with him. And when you get to, you know, someone like Sean Reingold, who played Sugar, Sean Reingold was somebody who was not supposed to make it out of episode one of Luke Cage. Because the interesting factoid of that episode, you know, the last part when they're in Connie's and you have the thugs and saying, you know, give Mariah Diller, you know, what's due. Yeah. Interesting is that Sean played Suge Knight in Notorious, the movie that I co-wrote about Notorious B.I.G. And the actor who we ended up actually having get hit with, you know, and his fist breaking on Luke's hand, he played Suge straight out of Compton. So we have the only scene where you have both Suge Knights in one scene. And it was, when we got to that one line that honestly was my version, this was me biting Iron Man 3. Shane Black, who is one of the greatest genre writers of all time, you know, Shane Black had this great moment in Iron Man 3 where this henchman like said, hey, I just started working on Friday or whatever, and he runs off, right?
Yeah.
That was my version of that. I said, you know, when you got to all these people getting their ass kicked by Luke Cage, and he gets to this one guy, and then you, what's he gonna say? And he says, I don't even like these niggas, man. You know, the way that Sean said it, whether he realizes it or not, and I told Sean this. I knew I had an actor that I always just wanted to, anytime I could, give him stuff to do. And there were numerous times where we needed somebody, you know, to go. And we couldn't kill him off. And so finally, when we got to the finale, to the last three episodes of Luke Cage season two, seeing him and how he was going to be Luke's number two, that was one of the things that would have been really cool to explore. Because the moment that I wrote for him in the finale of Luke Cage, where he gives his backstory about, you know, about why he worked for Mariah Dillard. And then ultimately, when you see him talking to Luke and, you know, Rosalie Carbone is in VIP, and like they had a great chemistry too. So it would have been really interesting to also kind of see, you know, what they would have done. And then, of course, you know, what we were able to do with Jeremiah Kraft, you know, who really bought a lot of these great moments into DW. Like some of my favorite moments in the show were those moments that had nothing to do with our main characters, but like you could have very easily had their own shows. Like, you know, I thought that, you know, he had these great moments. Like, like he wasn't really supposed to be a character. Like he was somebody that I remember when we had episode one, like I said, how would Harlem react to what happened in the Avengers? And I said, yo, if somebody videotaped that shit, they'd sell it on 125th Street. So that was the whole thing. I said, okay, you know, and so that's how we cast him. Because it you know, when he has that line, you know, like, you know, the green monster, the guy with the hammer, like, you know, I just put myself, what would it be like to be near 125th and somebody selling copies of what they filmed with DIY footage of what happened? And because he was so great in that one cameo moment, I said, let's keep bringing him back. And that's ultimately how he became who we turned into D.W. Griffith from the comic book and gave him a name and put him as D.W. in, you know, really more expansively in season two of Luke Cage. But yeah, I mean, we were just lucky to have people on their A game, no matter how big or small the part, you know, and it's a show that I'm just so incredibly proud of, and at the same time just have so much fun even to this day tweeting about, because I'm loving that people are rediscovering the show. And I think what's really interesting is, like, ever since they put Luke Cage next to Echo on Disney Plus, since they bought Daredevil back, what's been great is by putting all of our shows on that tier and making Echo part of the Defenders arc, it's brought a lot of traffic back to Luke Cage. I'm seeing an uptick in engagement on people just watching Luke Cage for the first time. And what happened, I think, is that because Echo was such a cool show and it's being placed in, because it's a limited series, people are like, wait a minute, I've run out of Echo. I still need my fix. What are these other shows? And then that's when we discovered Daredevil. They're like, holy shit. And then people are now doing the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so I think some people are going to love Luke Cage. Some people might not like Luke Cage, but I'm proud of what we did. And I think the big surprise is that people, you kind of take for granted that everybody has seen all these shows, but they really haven't. And so what's great is like when they get to Luke Cage now, it's like they're kind of surprised by it and in a cool way. And so I think what's great is that it really hasn't aged as much as you would think it would over almost 10 years since we filmed it. But I'm just really so gratified and just so lucky to have the writers, the actors, and everybody that I had from top to bottom on that show. It was just such an incredible moment, honestly.
Yeah, we're lucky to have it, even incomplete. Hopefully someday it'll be completed. So as our final question, most of our listeners are fans of the shows, of the movies. If you were going to recommend one comic Luke Cage arc for it to introduce the fans to the character, what would you recommend?
Well, this is my cat, Myra. I'm not the godfather. She's hungry. You're not on this. You can't answer the question. No. You can't answer the question. No. Okay. I would say the Brian Michael Bendis Alias, which technically is a Jessica Jones story.
Yeah.
But that really defined, comic book wise, who we were going to make Luke Cage. Because when you see their interaction in terms of who they are together and what that was, that kind of set the tone for this television version of Luke Cage. And, you know, the Bendis arc, I mean, Luke ends up joining the new Avengers and the Avengers and all that stuff. Yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of people that say, oh, well, that's how he should be now introduced into, you know, the larger Marvel universe and all of that. So I'm not saying that that's the way to do it. But what I will say is that Bendis's modernization of the characters, if you're looking to see something that fits my television version of Luke Cage, that's more likely where you would go if you need the comic book equivalent of that. You know, the classic version of Luke Cage, I mean, you know, those are still great comics. But they didn't really flavor our TV show as much as, you know, the Luke Cage Bendis Alias arc did.
All right, Cheo, well, thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been an honor to have you. I could listen to you for hours, but we're running short on time.
and thank you for tolerating me, because I tend to ramble, and I don't mean to, but it's just, when you get these floods of memories, like, when you write a show, but at the same time, you're also a part of, you know, all those great moments we had in the writer's room, and then also post-production and being on and off set. Like, I basically have almost like an encyclopedic memory of every single shot, of every single scene, of every single performance of, you know, 26 episodes of television just in my head. And it's crazy sometimes to have all that and then to be able to talk about certain things and have a moment to talk about it. And that's really what I loved and appreciated about what you guys are doing with this cast, is the fact that you're, you know, talking about the episodes. And so thank you for having me on. At the same time, if you want to revisit, you know, any of these episodes, I'd love to do it. And also, like, I can't really speak for, you know, Akela or Aida or Charles or Jason or you know, are the writers, but I'm sure that they would have similar responses, because everybody that's worked on the show, I mean, we all love it. So, you know, I think it would be great to talk about all this stuff.
Yeah, we'd love to do that. Before we sign off, is there, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online, if you want to plug anything?
Nothing to plug. I mean, I'm working on a lot of stuff, but nothing I'm going to plug yet.
Yeah.
I learned my lesson with Luke Cage season one, not to plug anything because, as I said, when I first got announced as a showrunner for Luke Cage, it was the greatest 20 minutes of my life. And then Flood came in and I was like, oh my God, it's terrible. It was so stressful.
Yeah.
And ever since I'm like, I don't publicize shit until it's coming out.
Right.
But yeah, they can find me on Twitter, Chael_Coker, you know, that's where you're at. I mean, if you Google me, if you put my name on Twitter, it pops up because I'm active enough. And you know, it's fun for me because a lot of trolls kind of come at the show or say I'm like Candyman. If you say my name four times, I'm there.
No, I love to see you fight back too. I love it.
it's fun. Like, but I think sometimes people take it too seriously, and then they get really angry or they get really hurt by some of the things people say. And for me, it's just like, I just like the interaction of back and forth.
Yeah.
And procrastination, of course, is great. Anything that takes me away from the actual work I have to do, I enjoy. Yeah. But it's funny because I think that fans sometimes they're surprised that it's actually me interacting. Mm-hmm. Or at the same time, I think it's important for fans to understand that we as creators are people, same as anybody else. And we feel the same way. And sometimes even have the same frustrations that people have with how things turn out. And so to keep that in mind sometimes when you're going after a writer specifically, I mean, I've spent the last 3 days defending the writer of Madam Web, even though I never met the guy. But because some of the fans were so personal and scathing and disrespectful at how they came at him, I had to step in and be like, yo, like, you have no idea what you're talking about in this way. Because the person that you're saber rattling at might not have been anything to do with some of these decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's just the whole process is just like, you know, I think it's important to always keep an open dialogue. I'm not saying that people are above reproach or above criticism, certainly not. Yeah. But I think that having an open dialogue is important. And so I just thank you for inviting me on. I really appreciate it.
Again, thank you, Chael, for coming on the show. And everyone listening, join us next time as we begin our coverage of Iron Fist Season 2. Episode 1 is The Fury of the Iron Fist. Please remember to follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Give us a 5-star rating. And as always, this is the Marvel Cinematic Rewind signing off. Have a marvelous day. Enemy.